Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Salita, and I am the host of Through the Eyes of the Black Woman here on Say Your Peace Radio Network. And as you can see, we have a conversation with Shawanda Pugh. Am I saying that right, ma'am?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So we're going to talk about Shawanda today. This is her day. And we're going to talk about her book, both of them. She's the author of Crimson Footprints 1 and 2. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So, first of all, this is what we need to do. We need to give out the number just in case anyone who wants to call in and talk to Ms. Pugh. The number is 347-677-1749. Now, first of all, I want to say good evening, ma'am. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm fine. I'm excited to talk to you about your book. Okay.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this.
Okay. First of all, tell the audience, listening audience, about yourself.
Okay. My name is Shawanda Pugh. I'm a relatively new author. I just debuted last August with the Crimson Footprint series with Delphine Publications. That came out in August of last year. I'm a writer. I was meant to be a writer. I went to school for writing. I do freelance writing, freelance editing on the side. So just I'm a writer through and through. I didn't actually start out that way, though. I switched over to writing from law school. I was actually in law school, and I left law school to pursue a master's in writing, and that's when I really started taking what was a hobby seriously. So before that, it was just like a thing that I did for myself.
Man, so you are an ex-law student?
Yeah. I was in law school down here in Miami. Before that, I went to undergrad at Alabama A&M University. I had a political science degree that I got from there. So you can see that I was on that law track, and I just kind of, like, jumped the rails at the last second. I was sitting in class, actually, and I didn't know whether I was there for myself or for other people, and I realized that it was time for me to get up and leave. You know, there's
man.
So much, you know, hoopla surrounding going to law school, and everyone's so proud of you, and after a while you're like, wait a minute, do I even want to be a lawyer? And, yeah, that's what happened to me, and I got up and left and made a lot of people unhappy.
Yeah,
I was on scholarship and everything, so that didn't go really well.
Well, wait a minute, it didn't go as well for them.
Yeah, right. I mean, I love it now. I'm doing what I was meant to do. It feels right. And that never really felt right, so, you know, it was to get over.
You were more under pressure opposed to perform.
Right, and it was other people, and it was me, too. I can't, you know, just put it all on other people, but that's, you know, a little bit of the background. Before that, I grew up in Boston in the inner city. I lived there quite a few years before moving to Miami for a couple of years, and then Alabama for college, and then back to Miami. So I've been kind of all over the place.
Mm-hmm. So are you in Miami now?
I am in Miami now. I've been here quite a few years, and this is home now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have any kids? Are you married?
I am married. I have a 4-year-old son, and that's the whole of that. I tend not to, you know, go, like, ramble off too much about, like, the husband and the kid and that kind of thing. Writing's my thing. So I try to put that little bubble around my family as much as possible, even if it's, you know, not totally possible. Because some people are weird, I found.
What? Why you say that?
I have some really, really awesome fans that, you know, have come about from the Crimson Footprint series. I have people that, you know, find me on Facebook every day, and they find me on my blog, and they find every sort of way there is to find me, they find me. And okay. They say some really wonderful things, but every so often I get some really weird things, too. So I do. I did a radio show once, and I had a guy call in, you know, he was really excited, and you could tell he'd read the book. Because he knew, you know, all about the characters, but he was also breathing really heavy on the phone and doing weird stuff. So, you know, they had to, like, cut the phone call short. Yeah, so, you know, I write romance, and the romance gets racy, and apparently people really take that to heart.
So you're not...
Oh, you know, yeah, life has gotten really interesting for me.
You're not Zane Junior, are you?
No, it's not. It's not Zane. Actually, people have really called it more of a literary romance.
Okay.
More than anything, but my sex scenes, I write my sex scenes. I don't shy away from them.
Yeah.
And people really seem to enjoy them. I remember when I was in grad school, my thesis instructor, she... would, you know, go over parts of the story because the story, the initial story, a smaller version of it, was my thesis for grad school. So she went over it, and she actually read one of the love scenes, and she came back and she said, wow, you really know how to write a sex scene. And we're talking, this is, I don't know, maybe like a 60-something-year-old white woman, so it's funny. Kind of fan yourself, like, wow, that was good.
Coming from her.
And I'm thinking, do you need a moment?
You'd be like, do you need a moment? Step away.
Exactly. I'm like, do you need a moment? I'm sorry.
Ah.
So, you know, I get that, and I also get the people that really appreciate the story for the story, that read it and read it again, and they find the layers in there and the thought that went into it, and they see the foreshadowing and things that they didn't see that first time when they just kind of raced through it. So I have different sorts of fans. So there's room for everybody. You know, you have those folks that just kind of want to flip to the racy parts, and you have the people that really, you know, just enjoy the story as it's unfolding. And, I mean, hey, there's room for everybody.
Okay, that's what, you know, since you mentioned the racy part, you have your book available.
Let me pick it up. I have the first one available. Funny, I haven't received the second one yet because that one comes out in about another week or so. So I don't have that.
So right on hand. Before you get done tonight, you will be reading a racy scene. Okay.
Okay. We can do that. That's something I've never done before.
Always what they say. First time for everything.
You're right. I'm with it. I'm game if you are.
Okay. So this is what I want to do. I want you to tell us about the characters, how you developed your characters.
Okay.
Basically, do a little summary of the story. And I'm going to let you talk. I'm not going to interrupt you that much. I like to let people talk because then that's how my questions come from when you're talking, not when I'm asking you the questions. I might do mine a little different. And I don't try to format everything because everybody's not going to give me the same answer to, you know, the same situation or the different situation. So, I want you, first of all, let's talk about your characters, how you developed them. Are they real people or are they imaginary people? And who are the characters in the book? Who's the main person? Who's the, you know, the protagonist and the antagonist in the story? You know, you know.
Sure. Okay.
The short
version. My characters were developed. Actually, the hero was developed first. His name is Takumi Tanaka. He's a Japanese American male, and I developed him as part of my fiction writing class when I was in grad school. And it was kind of a reluctant thing. You know how you get those assignments and you think they're really stupid, and you're just doing it because you need the grade.
Yeah.
And this was one of those things where my professor told me that I needed to go and sit in a public place and people watch for a few hours. And I needed to people watch until I came up with a character.
Yes.
And so my first thought was, I'm not doing that. I'm going to just make up somebody and go about my business. Except I couldn't. I couldn't come up with anybody. So I went and I sat in a Barnes & Noble for a couple of hours. And this guy comes in, and he's black, and he has, like, all these tattoos. And you know the look, just the jeans sagging and the T-shirt and that kind of thing. And he has the headphones from the iPod on and that kind of thing. And he goes straight to the literary section and picks up a Poe, just Edgar Allan Poe. And he's standing there and he's reading it. And he's in there like forever. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, wow, shut me up. Because, you know, I'm thinking he's going back to the magazine section or, you know, where the CDs are, the DVDs, that kind of thing. He goes straight for Edgar Allan Poe, and his nose is in the spine. He's in it so good. You know, so I'm thinking, okay, I learned my lesson. So I went, and I wanted to create a character that wasn't what he appeared to be.
Okay.
And at the time, I was really into Japanese horror. This was back when The Grudge was really big, and all these different kind of horror films that came out of Japan. So I knew a little bit about Japanese culture. That's what I was thinking. I knew a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out I knew nothing. So I started doing a lot of research, and I had to do quite a bit of digging because Japanese-American culture is distinctly just different from Japanese culture, but that's another story. So I start crafting this guy, and I think about all the stereotypes that kind of revolve around Asian Americans. So I like list all the stereotypes. And then I make sure I get rid of all of them. He can't have any of those stereotypes. So I start out and I create this guy, and like he just jumps off the page. He's so alive. And like every female that I talk to, they're like, oh my God, I'm so in love with him. Please tell me he's real. Please tell me he's somewhere. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you're in love with me. I made him up. So that's the guy. And so after the guy, I wondered what kind of girl would he be with. And he would obviously be with someone that broke the mold. It wouldn't be the sort of girl that you would expect him to be with. So I came up with my heroine second, and she was kind of like this insular figure, really shy. But she was very street savvy because she grew up in a rough neighborhood in Miami, but she kind of transcended whatever barriers she had and that kind of thing. And they meet in Crimson Footprints 1, basically the opening scene. They meet because he turns down the wrong street, and he's about to get carjacked by her brother.
Oh, man.
So she's in the house. She hears shouting. She comes out. He's getting carjacked. She stops it. And there's this moment between them, not much, but something very small. And then he goes on about his business, and she goes in the house, and they're both thinking about each other, but they're two strangers, end of story.
Mm-hmm.
Except her brother dies the same night, and he's not the brother, Takumi, the main male figure. He is absolutely obsessed with her. He just keeps thinking about her, keeps thinking about how she's so unlike anything that he's ever experienced in his privileged life and so on and so forth. And so he's, like, so obsessed with her. And when her brother gets killed, he sees the caption in the newspaper, and he remembers, this is the same guy that tried to jack me the other day. And he says, this is how I can see her again. And so he goes to the funeral, and that's basically how the story opens. And they find out that they have all these other things in common that wouldn't necessarily be obvious. Like, it turns out this super mega firm that she works for, she's an architect, is actually run by his father. And his father has, like, this iron fist, and she idolizes him. And so there are all these other dynamics that come into play. He's very rich. She has never had much, although she has a lot now, but it's all been through her scraping and hard work and college and that kind of thing, because she's never really had that much. And they start this romance, and she's very hush-hush about the romance because she was raised by her grandmother and her grandfather, and they're very, like, old Alabama religious, I don't believe in interracial romance especially not an Asian guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how their romance begins, and it's okay with him, you know, at the time, because,
mm-hmm.
he, you know, he's really into her, and he takes it, but eventually, you know, the romance goes on and on, and he's like, okay, how long is this going to go on?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like the basic dynamic of the story. There are a lot of side characters. I spend time developing minor characters really well, enough that people tell me, you know, I could basically make a story about each of the minor characters. I spend enough time, like, investing in them and making sure they're worth reading about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Crimson Footprints 1, and the heroine is Dina, and the hero is Takumi, or Tak is what he's usually called.
Okay. So, okay. Now, okay, the name of the book is Crimson Footsteps. I mean, Footprints.
Crimson Footprints. That's the first one. Right.
Okay.
That's been out since last August, so it's available just about anywhere. You can get it on any e-reader, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble Small Press actually just picked it up, so you can actually go into Barnes & Noble and pick up a copy if you don't want to order one through the mail or whatever. So that's really
okay. Where did you get the title from? Tell us how you got the title.
Oh, I can and I can't.
Okay.
It refers to a really, really pivotal scene
In the book,
and it's like this transition where everything makes sense to Dina and everything makes sense to the reader, and it's very literal on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's very much like a reflection and everything just coming back around and forcing her into making these tough decisions that you know she has to make from the start, because you know you can't sneak around very long and that kind of thing without it all coming back to hurt you.
Okay, so in the book, she's not prohibited to see this guy?
She, the prohibitions that she has are all in her mind placed on herself.
Okay.
Put another way, she's a grown woman. She doesn't live with anyone. She makes her own money, that kind of thing. But she has this need to be a part of this family that isn't really all that receptive to her to start out with. They're not that receptive to her because of her background, because she's black and she's white, because of the circumstances that she came to live with her grandparents. Dina came to live with her grandparents after her white mother killed her black father. And so there is this underlying sort of animosity towards her because she looks more like her mother than she does her father, and she acts more like her mother than her father, and so she kind of annoys them in one sense, and in the other sense they feel like that's kind of like the proof that this is the sort of thing, these are the sort of relationships that are just going to wind up not working because there are too many dynamics. She's Christian, Thak's Buddhist, he's Asian, she identifies herself as black, and they feel like these are things that are just not meant to work out. And even though she doesn't feel that way, she doesn't have the courage to say that she doesn't feel that way. So she kind of skulks and sees him here and there, and they have this hidden romance that is only meant to be hidden for so long because it's not possible to go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much how that works.
Okay. So it's not only societal looking at it, and it's her, too, dealing with her own fears about how she sees relationships or the race of the people she has relationships with. Is that on his end, too?
You're right, because she, like a lot of people, has this preoccupation with what other people think. You see that with her family. You see that at work. She's bothered when people whisper, when she begins spending a lot of time with Tak's father, who is this icon in architecture, and she's spending time with him as a mentor because he sees potential in her. But there are people that don't like that she gets to spend this time on certain projects and learning basically at his knee, and so they say nasty things, and she really takes it to heart. She really spends a lot of time wondering, is this what people think about me, when basically she should know that it doesn't really matter. But she goes through these rough patches where it does matter to her more than it should, and it affects her on several levels.
It's like he wants to be with her, she wants to be with him, but she's kind of ashamed of dealing with him. How is he taking it?
Well, in the beginning, he's receptive to it, because in the beginning he feels like, well, this can't last. This is just what she needs right now. She'll build up her courage. I'll be here when she does, and it'll be okay. But time goes on, and it is lasting. And he starts to press her, but she's resistant to it.
Mm-hmm.
She's resistant to it because, you know, she's fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that goes on and on through the story without me giving too much away.
Mm-hmm.
And it culminates, as I'm sure readers would expect it to.
Okay. You know, I hear you talking about the racial thing. Okay, let me ask you this, if you don't mind, and I'm going to see if I can relate. Now, not only is she getting flack, is she just basically getting flack from all the other races, or her race?
It's really just her family, and it's not even everyone in her family. It's certain people in her family, and you know how the loudest voice gets heard.
Yeah.
And so there are just certain people in her family. Her grandmother, who, you know, raised her and whose voice holds a lot of sway with her, is one of them. And she has a cousin that's pretty nasty about it. And, you know, so it's just certain members that say something. But it's not like something that's going on out in public, in the city. People are turning their noses down. It's not like that. It's just those people. And that's why she's able to hide it so well, because she just doesn't bring him home with her.
Okay. The reason why I asked you that was because her story is almost similar to a situation that happened to me when I was stationed in Germany. And I started dating, I don't know why, I started dating this white guy. Oh my God, why did I do that? And during the time that we dated, when he started coming over to my barracks, he lived in a different area. When he come to my barracks and picked me up, I got called the worst name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can imagine. You ain't nothing but a white man's bitch. You ain't nothing but a white man's hoe. He can't do nothing for you but lick you in. Because I know he ain't
got
These are the guys I had to work with every day, because I worked with a lot of guys. My job had me where I worked
with a lot of guys. I imagine you were in barracks,
Yeah, and so they, you know, they had this ownership type, this invisible ownership of all the females. And if they can't get to them, we'll make it hard for anybody else to deal with them. You know what I'm saying?
But he stuck
in there. I mean, he didn't, you know, he didn't sway, but I brought him home. I did the craziest thing. I brought him home one Christmas, and I live here in Louisiana. You know, you don't bring no white man home to Louisiana. Oh, my God. It was the worst. It was almost worse than what I went through when we were stationed in Germany. I would be in the grocery store, and he had a habit of PDA. I used to have a thing about public display of affection. I didn't like it.
I'm kind of like that.
Well, one day, we were in the grocery store. We went grocery shopping. And he did it. He came up behind me. I'm not going to say what he did. But this lady dropped her fruit. She was looking so...
Oh, my God. And this is here in the States.
She was shocked because I'm with a white guy, and I'm dark-skinned. I'm with this white guy. He's touching all over me. And they were like, this was back in the 80s, so you know.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
We weren't ready. So it was like she dropped her fruit. She was looking at us so hard. And then they rolled their eyes at me. We got to the counter. They snatched the money out my hand. I mean, you could see the reaction. How dare
Right, just, just real, just visceral, yeah.
So that's why I asked that question about how did society take it. My mom loved him. I didn't have any problem out of any of my family members because I've always been the one who's kind of unique in them, so they kind of expect anything from me.
But, right, yeah, I'm that one too.
You know what? Absolutely, that's how she is. Don't be surprised when she does. But when you was talking about your characters, I was like, man, that sounds just like me. But at first I was like, why is this white guy wanting to date me? What the hell is this? You know, I'm like, what the heck? But we actually stayed together for 3 years, and it surprised the hell out of me.
Wow.
It worked. But anyway, I was saying that because I was thinking about how society treated me, and it was my own people. When I say my own people, I mean my black people that treated me, worse than anybody else really did. It was my own people.
Right. And that's exactly how I portrayed in that. What I wanted to do, I kind of wanted to contrast those two worlds because Dina and Tak live in Miami Beach, and Miami Beach is, you know, everyone knows South Beach, really forward-thinking, and you're going to see pretty much anything there. Not only are you going to see interracial couples, but you're going to see interracial couples of the same sex. You're going to see transsexuals.
Uh-huh.
You're going to see, you know, anything you can think of, you're going to see it on South Beach, and people aren't going to look twice. And so I wanted to contrast this kind of anything world with her family, and they're both they're equally valid. They're both, you know, reality. So I wanted to, that's why I kept all the tension for the most part within her family. Now, there is one other source of tension, and that comes from his father. His father is also against his son dating anyone that isn't Japanese. And I present that very differently. His father's reason for that is because Asian Americans have a very high interracial marriage rate, and I think Japanese Americans marry at a rate of about 50% outside of their race.
Mm-hmm.
And so his concern is that, you know, another generation or two at that rate, they wouldn't even be Japanese anymore. And so his father is very much about, like, upholding old traditions and heritage and that kind of thing. So I don't always present it like it's this hostile thing to be against. I present it like there's some validity in everyone's point, and it's just a matter of deciding what's right for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. You explained it correctly. I mean, you went there to make me think about why would you have a problem with that. But, again, we have to think about society when it comes to white people. White people feel the same way. They feel like their lineage or their heritage is slowly dwindling. As you notice, and it's being proven that they're not having babies like they used to. White women are more into their careers. So the baby boom for white people are not the same as all the other race of people. And that's a problem they're having, and they're trying to encourage more women to have babies. And the women is like, I'm not having it.
I'm with the white women.
I stopped that one too, baby, so don't feel. Mine's 29. He'd be 30 next year.
I have one son. He's 4, and, I'm all about the career now.
Yeah, and it works. My thing is, and I was telling one of the other authors I interviewed, I was telling her how I got on my knees. I said, God, if I'm going to have this baby, I want it to be a boy. I don't want a girl. So I got on my knees and prayed, and he gave me a boy.
Now, what was that about?
Because I was raised in a house with girls. There was 5 girls.
Okay.
And I
was just making sure you weren't pulling that China one child policy. We need boys.
Well, actually,
I was just checking.
Shoot, we do need some more boys because they keep locking them up.
We need to get the ones straight that we have.
Yeah, that's right. We need to keep them straight and out of jail. No, I said I didn't want another girl, and I don't think the world can handle another Salida. I just don't think they can handle another one of these.
I could see because my son is me in a lot of ways, and yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think there needs to be too much more of that going around.
But you know, once he's only four, you wait till he really, really, really starts to present his own personality, and you're going.
Oh,
really
he does. He's very stubborn, very adamant. He's He already he knows everything already.
Uh huh. Yeah.
And he's willing to tell you. Yeah, he has it all worked out already at four.
But you know what I do? I used to call them space age kids. I really did because I said these kids are coming out so smart and intelligent.
Yeah.
And I said these are space age kids. You know, stuff you could never think that they would know, they know. You put a computer in front of them, they'll know that computer quicker. You let them sit there for hours and hours at a time. They're going to learn on that computer. They don't need you to help them.
Yeah, because he's adept on a laptop and desktop. He's fine. He'll go to Nick Jr. and do whatever it is. Yeah. He doesn't need me. He's already. Yeah, we call him Grown Man Baby. Because he's both, you know, so, yeah.
He's crazy and plus he's grown, and he's probably
Yeah, close. Exactly. If you were to meet him, that's the perfect name for him. It works.
I like that. I've never heard that before. I like Grown Man Baby. I like that.
Yeah, that's what we call him, yeah.
Okay, now, let's talk about the second half of Crimson Footprint.
Okay, in Crimson Footprints 2, I shift from Dina to Dina's sister, who made an appearance in the first one, but she wasn't a central character. She's significantly younger than Dina. She's about, I think she's 12 when she first appears, or 13, and she's going through her teenage years, and she's just completely out of control. She lives with the grandmother, but the grandmother's getting old, maybe a little bit senile, and she's out, and she's all about money, and she just descends into this world of complete madness. And of course, on the other end are men who are willing to take advantage of that. So her sister just goes, and she descends into this world of drugs and sex and just... no education, and the first one, after I released it, a lot of people were unhappy because they felt like she didn't get enough resolution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'd score the book, you know, it was excellent, I loved it, I just wished that, you know, her sister had turned out this way and that way, and wished this had happened, except for me as a writer, I felt like for what her sister went through, that would have been unrealistic and insincere on my part. I don't necessarily write neat, happy endings. I like to just see where it goes. And so with Crimson Footprints 2, I pick up with her sister. And her sister's an adult, and she's in this world of money and sex and drugs. And... for Crimson Footprints 2, she wants to transcend that, except she feels trapped. And her course for redemption is love, and it's self-discovery, and it's love in a way that I know a lot of readers are going to be like, where'd she get that from? Where did that come from? Because I really, really sideline you with it.
Uh-huh.
So... that's the whole of Crimson Footprints 2. I know a lot of people were really interested to see what happened with Lizzie, my caller that I told you about, that called up breathing heavy. He wanted to know all about Lizzie's descent into the sex world. So and so he'll find out some more in the second one. So if no one else is pleased, he'll be pleased.
He will be if nobody else.
Yeah, I know that I'll have that one fan out there.
Oh boy.
But yeah, but that's Crimson Footprints too. She goes through this. She's finally at a place where she wants out, and she finds out in a very unlikely way and with a very unlikely person.
Uh-huh.
And what I really like about what I did with Crimson Footprints, too, for anyone who reads a lot of romance, you uh-huh. tend to find that all the men are alpha males. And
okay.
even in my first one, Tack is an alpha male, even though he
What's
has...
behind that?
I think that it's just, number one, I like alpha male, so if you write what you like, that's the first
okay.
thing. And then the second thing is that it's easy for a woman to get behind a man that knows what he wants, is adamant about what he wants, that can take charge when he needs to, is confident, and all these things that we put on a pedestal and expect men to be. So it's a very easy sell when you create a guy that alpha male. You have to be careful, though, because you can turn him from an alpha male basically into a jackass if you're not careful. But what I did that was a little different in Crimson Footprints 2 is that the hero in this one is not the obvious kind of alpha male. He's more a beta male.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't always do that obviously courageous thing. He doesn't always take that leadership role, but he wants to. And so with him and her, they both go on this discovery, and he kind of rises up towards the end where he becomes this person that he wants to be, that he feels like he should be, because he's also a character in the first novel, and he's younger. And so I have to kind of shake that stigmatism of him being young in the first one and give him that, shake off the child shackles and make him a man. So that it's a tough sell, but it happens, and it goes really well. And I'm told that people, for the few people that have read and reviewed the novel ahead of time, they actually enjoy it more than the first one, and that's saying a lot, because I've gotten a really awesome response from Crimson Footprints 1.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so
you named another book that you didn't talk about.
Well, actually, no, I only have the two. I do have a new series that's supposed to be coming out in the fall, and that has all new characters. That's like new adult. It's a different genre. It's new adult romance. I know everyone's not familiar with new adult. It's kind of that threshold between young adult and adult, just to kind of put it there. So kind of like that age when you go off to college and you're just kind of finding yourself. So it's a new adult series with the male character there is Asian Indian,
okay.
and the girl is African American. She's not mixed or anything. We're doing black and Indian, and they're next door neighbors, and they're raised basically almost as if they're brother and sister, because their fathers are very close. They live next door to each other. Their fathers went to college together. They take all their vacations together and this sort of thing, except he's Indian, and he's a very old and traditional Indian who is supposed to have this arranged marriage when he gets older and all these things, except the two of them fall in love. And so he doesn't want that, and she wants him, and now there's like hell in both families because their families are very, very close, except... Now, on the one hand, it seems almost as if it's racist because they don't want him to be with her because they have these old traditions, and their old traditions don't include anything about any black women. So there's that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, there's the friendship between the fathers and the children and the mothers, and there are a lot of family dynamics going on, and also, you know, between the family and between the pair. Which is something that my readers are finding out I tend to do quite a bit, like family dynamics and romance. I always pair the two together because that's the thing that I love to kind of flirt with.
Mm-hmm. Now, is he an Indian, Native American Indian, or Indian?
No. He's Asian Indian. His family is from India.
Okay, Indian.
Right.
Okay.
His family is from just north of Delhi. He's never been, he was actually born in Boston, they grew up in Boston, so he's thoroughly Americanized. Now, he is the severe alpha male. He's actually like this football player and just this really jock. And I really had fun making him because when you think Indian, you don't think football player.
That's exactly what I was getting ready to say.
Yeah, but I really pull it off. He is really just this this raging kind of, and he has the a-hole complex from time to time, so there are times where he's, like, too much jock, and you have to kind of push him back, like, you know, get off the steroids and that kind of thing. But, you know, he's not. He's just him. So there's a lot of fun in there. I enjoy kind of shaking off the stereotypes and having fun with them. He's the football player. She's a ballerina. You don't hear that much about black ballerinas, but they are out there. So I have fun with the two of them too. So that's another series. That's not until fall.
Mm-hmm.
So and that will be called Love Edie when that comes out. But right now, Crimson Footprints and Crimson Footprints 2 are the main things. And Crimson Footprints 2, I know a lot of people have been asking, comes out in all the ebook formats this week. I'm not sure of the exact hour, but it will be out this week, and the paperback debuts the 26th across all formats. So,
dang.
Yeah, well, I know people have been kind of ticked off with me, so the wait is over.
Yeah, they're like, get it out there. You know, I know how that's feeling. Like, when are you going to write another
book? Yeah, they get kind of ornery.
Yeah, the thing is, you get so preoccupied. I've gotten so preoccupied with radio that I've really neglected my first love, which is writing.
Right.
I've gotten so into this radio thing that I really, really kind of got away. Even though, and that's why when I created the show that I created, it was called Lily Author Showcase, was for me to step down away from me and allow other people to promote other people that have books out there. And I mean, one of my very first persons that I interviewed was Kimberly Roby Lawson. You know who that is, right?
Mm-mm.
The one who wrote Be Careful Who You Pray For.
Oh, I haven't. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, she was one of my very first persons that I interviewed.
And what year was that?
That was in 2010, 2011.
Okay, yeah, that was a little way.
So, it was like, because that was the first time I had opened up my show, and I went on local radio to do it. And, and the show just took off, and no one was doing what I was doing with my show as far as interviewing and promoting. And I started from authors, and then we added artists on. So it just blew up. We got syndicated in 8 months after I got on air. So it was like, man. And then you know what? It was like, you know what? Step back. Because I was like doing everything. And I was like, let me step back. And then when I let them know that we were going off air, people was like, what the hell? You going off air? Because it was the show so much. Because it was a team. It wasn't just me. It was a couple other people, too. My son came in. I mean, everybody would come and just have a good time. But anyway, so I had to stop that. And it was like, you know what? There's nobody who's going to do what you do. And there hasn't been anybody who's been able to follow in that footstep. Not to say I'm this great big personality or anything, but it's the idea I took something that nobody was doing, and that was taking our authors and putting them on a platform and actually letting them talk about their book and promote their book. I've even had people come in. Our local authors came in and did books. So we just had a good time. And I thought, you know, I could step back and do that and let somebody else get the glory. You know, every now and then you do that. And I thought I was finished with it, but obviously I still love talking to people about their books because I learned so much from you guys. The things that I don't know, you guys know, you know, and because we don't run in the same circle. We might all be authors and writers, but we're not in the same circle as everyone else. So when
there are so many out there.
Yes. So when I talk to you guys, it's like, man, I'm like, man, this stuff is really cool. So I'm like, okay, so you need to get back to your writing again because I'm telling you, I have put everything down and just concentrated on doing my radio, and I'm in school at the same time. So I said, no, I need to get back to writing. And more I talk to you guys and listen to how fun and how happy you guys are doing what you love. My first love was writing, and I kind of just put it to the side, like it doesn't matter anymore, which it really does.
And you have to just do a little bit at a time. Not so much. A lot of the time when writers write, they're very concerned with what they're writing at that moment, and they're editing and they're writing and they're like, this sucks, and they're tearing it up right there at that moment, and you can't really be that way. You have to kind of just let it all fall out and sort it out later. What you might write day one, day two, day seven, it might all be garbage. But you're writing, and you're establishing a pattern, and even if it's just a few minutes a day, that was something that when I was younger and really just starting to take my writing seriously, that was something that I made sure I wrote every single day. When I got my master's, I was halfway through, I got pregnant with my son, and people were like, my God, how are you doing all this? Because like when I graduated, I had a little bitty baby, and I'm like in this honor society, and I have these honors, and I'm taking this many classes, and I'm writing a book, and I was writing Crimson Footprints then, and they were just like, my God, how are you doing it all? And it's like, it doesn't even matter if it's 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, just make sure you're writing, and it'll come back to you, because it comes back faster than it leaves.
Well, my problem is I'll start a good story, plot line, good characters and everything. And then it's like I don't know where else to go with it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, how are you going to finish this? How are you going to end this? So it's like I worry more about how to end my story than the bulk of it. The ending,
so you run heavy at the beginning. Okay.
Yeah. I get all my energy in there at the beginning, and then I kind of fizzle out when I get maybe right after the middle, you know, when it's time for it to start descending. That's when I'm like, okay, how am I going to end this book? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this is what I'm doing. And my first book, well, it's not actually my first book, but my first book dealing with characters, because I usually write about motivation and stuff like that. But my first book, I gave them a surprise, and they was like, there's no way you're going to end it like this. No, you got to have a part two. And I was like, no, once I write it, that's it. You can't. That story, like, you wrote part one and two, I can't. I've tried. I can't do two. I can't do three. I can't do the difference. It has to be that story that's in my spirit that I need to write. It's done.
I definitely get that. I had some prodding to do the part two, because part two wasn't on my mind when I wrote part one. But when people began prompting me, like, but we need to know more about this, and we want to know more about that, and I'm like, I can see that. I can see that. That's fair. Okay. So then I write part two, and part two just flows like it was already written, and I'm just regurgitating. It just goes. And then they're like, okay, are you going to do part three? And I said, absolutely not. And I'm like, I'm done. I don't want to talk about these characters anymore. I know you're just meeting them, but I have been with these people for years. And I'm done. But then I just got this big backlash. Like, come on, you are going to do part three, aren't you? You are going to do part three. And then my publisher's like, you are going to do part three, right? And then finally I was like, okay, fine, I'll do part three. And then I'm sitting there and I'm staring at the computer and I'm like, okay.
Okay, come on, part three. Here you go. Come on.
Yeah. And so I've had the situation where I hit the ground running, and I've had the situation where I'm just like dry heaving at the beginning and I have absolutely nothing. So I've been at all places now. Part three has been coming along, but I'm still in the writing stages for that. I'd say I'm probably about halfway. I hit a lull with that, but you know, I just picked it back up again. And we're expected to come out with that in the spring if I still have any hair and I haven't gouged my eyes out. You know, by the start of that, we'll be ready to go.
Where do your stories come from? I mean, how do you form your stories? Is it something you watch?
actually, and this is probably going to shock and appall you because it tends to with people, I don't watch TV. If you're lucky, you'll get like an hour of TV out of me a week. I don't watch TV.
Really?
I read and, like, I do a bit of social networking, and that's it. There isn't much on TV that appeals to me. So there's the one thing. So a lot of the stuff comes from me being a heavy reader and
mm-hmm.
just all the crap going on in my mind at once. Yeah, it's just, I swear, my husband thinks there are 10 people in my head with me. So they all get their own novels, is how that works.
Okay.
But
so you
all my characters tend to be a little bitty part of me, and I think it's just a matter of what part of me I'm emphasizing. And I know you've heard that before. Like, everyone says, you know, these characters are part of me, how else could I write them, that kind of thing. And sometimes it's very obvious to people, and sometimes it's not so obvious. Like, even the male characters. For example, Tech's father is very straight and narrow. He's very hard on his son. He's very hard on his employees. He demands perfection, that kind of thing. And some people that know me, they just know me as this, you know, silly person. I laugh, I talk. But that's me. That's also me. That's how I have the GPA and the degrees and the books that keep coming out. That's also me. I'm very diligent about certain things, and I'm very much a perfectionist about certain things, and I can be very hard on myself. And so that's that part of me coming out. And then in contrast, there's his son, who's this painter, and he's this artist, and he's just, like, above it all, and he's just contemplating life, and that's also me. That's the artistic part of me coming out. And so they seem like they're contrary people, but we're all contrary. We all have these, you know, these very different parts that make up the whole of us. And that's basically where I get my characters from. Now, as far as the storylines, scenes just kind of jump out at me, just kind of characters interacting, and things just happen, just very natural things happen when they interact, and maybe a song that prompts something, or just these two very different personalities interacting, and you know that's not going to go well the moment they interact, because they're just not meant to interact, and it kind of just writes itself. A lot of my stuff writes itself, and it's me going back and getting it together. And on the one hand, it sounds like what I'm writing is completely out of control, and sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's just a matter of the story just already being in me and me just kind of letting it out.
Okay.
Well, everywhere is my answer, basically.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, just everywhere, anywhere, the sun, the moon, yeah.
But you know what, like, I don't wake up in the middle of the night. And these characters and the storyline have come to me, or I've talked to a friend that a situation has happened, and I'll take her situation, and I'll use it. I've taken situations that happen to me, and I'll put them in. I'll put them bits and pieces of that situation, not necessarily me, but situations. Like someone asked me my book called The Secret Journal. Asked me, was the characters in the book me? And I was like, no, because it was a husband and wife team, and the husband cheated on the wife. And so they blatantly just asked me. I said, no. I said, my husband has never cheated on me, and I've never cheated on my husband. I said, no, these characters are not me. I mean, no. It's like I had to, like, Lita, you sure that ain't you? I'm positive it's not
me. Yeah, you're like, no, I have an imagination, an actual imagination.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'll race. Imagination. Like, one person said, Salita, you know what? Don't write that like that no more. I was like, what? What's wrong? That was kind of hot there, okay? Now that I've said that, let's get to the part I want you to do.
Oh, and you know what? I was actually just thumbing through this book trying to find a scene, like, while you said that, and I have not found a scene yet.
Okay, keep on looking. We can talk. We got time.
I'm gonna find something, because I have to, you know, I write. Let me just say this, since we're back on sex scenes. I know some people write sex scenes and they're just there to kind of titillate, and it's just that kind of instant gratification. There's nothing, and there's nothing wrong with that. But like, I'm a firm believer in sex advancing the plot.
Okay.
And so what I'm trying to do here is find a sex scene that doesn't advance the plot so much that I give away something that would be interesting for someone that will, you know, pick up the book tomorrow or whatever.
Uh-huh.
As odd as that may sound. So that's why I kind of rejected a couple of, like, one or two scenes that I saw, because I didn't want to. Like, I don't want to read the first time they're together, because that's, like, a really important scene.
That's
so
difficult.
I'm just kind of... Yeah, but I also want to give you a fair bit of play here. I don't want one where I just kind of gloss over, like, yeah, then they had sex. Even though I never quite say it like that, you get the idea. That's,
okay.
It's
now
the equivalent of that, like, the then they had sex thing.
Okay.
You know, it's funny, while you were talking about people thinking that everything is based on real life, and I don't know why that always happens, but you always get the weird questions. Like, I get the question, well, have you dated a Japanese guy? Well, are you sure? And, you know, you know, just like little
you
stuff like that.
You
just because, yeah, I'm like, well, if he was Japanese, I didn't know. You know, so it was just little things like that. Like, it just seems to be beyond people that you could have an imagination so vast that you can actually churn out a book.
Exactly.
And since that doesn't seem possible, you must be telling either your life story or someone else's life story.
Uh-huh.
That just seems like the first go-to for everyone.
You know something? Okay, I got a question. And
okay.
It's about the same thing. Now, let me ask you this. Do you find yourself, when you create these sex scenes that, is it, and I don't want to sound personal.
Okay.
I don't know, it might come out like that. But if you don't want to answer it, you don't have to. We'll put it to you like that.
Okay.
Do you find that you can put some of yourself in those scenes, or is just something you're using almost like a fantasy that you're actually writing? You understand what I'm saying?
It's actually, it's not like my fantasy. The sex scenes are very different depending on the characters. And they, like I was saying, I advance plot, so they're very specific to the characters. So I don't, like, leave character for the sex scenes and, you know, just kind of put what I wish would happen to me. I don't, you know, like, do like, that kind of thing. It's more like, okay, for example, Dina is a very subdued sort of person who's, you know, like, really into, like, self-reflection and what other people think about her. And so how she experiences sex is in that way. It's more reservation Tack, who's very, like, flesh and life and art, and he just feels deeply. And so he's, like, all in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different, and I go back between the two, and you get that very different experience when you experience it from her point of view as opposed to his point of view. So it's never, like, I'm really, like, far away from the sex scene when I'm writing the sex scene, and I try to be them as much as possible.
Okay. Look, you know what? I'm running out of time. Oh my God, Shawanda, can you do me a favor?
Okay.
Can you do me a favor?
What?
I want you to hold up. Let me see if I can do this real quick before it kicks me off. Hold up, just one second here.
Okay.
Let's see. See if it'll do it. Please let me on here. Let's see. Update it. I want to talk to you more. I don't want to let you go just yet.
Okay.
Let's see if it did it. Let's see. I'm sorry. Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
And I was just, I was like, okay, I'm just going to read this.
Okay. No, go ahead. Because I had to, wait a minute, let me close this out. This wasn't supposed to happen. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Now, you there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, go ahead. What happened was I was opening up another whole page with my show on it, and it was feeding back off of you. So go ahead. I apologize. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's
cool. I gave you some more time.
Oh, awesome. Okay. I have a section that I can read if you want. I won't go too deep into it. Yeah, that's the word I want to use. But, I can read one of the scenes here if you like.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay. I'll just jump right in. He snatched her to him, brought his mouth down hard on hers. She opened to meet him, willing, and a moan escaped. Resolve, resistance, rationale, all gone. When he finally withdrew, he was smiling. He returned to her mouth, his kisses demanding, impatient. His hands found her back, her waist, her ass, and greed. Dina was breathless with fear, anticipation, and arousal as her body told her what her mind had feared, that it was his, that it always had been his. Blindly, he fumbled with the lock and opened the door before backing her into the suite. She clung to him, whimpering, as his tongue ravished her mouth. He pulled away her blouse, exposing two bronze breasts, clad in frilly white. Jesus, he whispered. His mouth came down on hers again, swallowing, consuming her whole. He found her skirt and tossed it to the floor before pulling at his own clothes with impatience. She helped him, trembling fingers at the buttons of his shirt, near desperate to fill him. Tack lifted her, and instinctively, Dina's legs wrapped his waist. Their mouths met with abandon as he lowered her to the bed. You want this? He whispered. Dina blinked back tears. She felt so many things in that instant. Alarm and passion, nervousness and desire. And yes, she wanted him that bad. She brought a hand to his cheek and nodded, hoping he couldn't feel the tremble. Tack kissed her, a soft kiss, before lowering his mouth to her body. He trailed lips to her thighs, parted them, and licked. Dina yelped, back arched as she gripped the sheets and thrashed beneath him. Hot waves swept her, drowning her completely. With a flick of the tongue, he'd humbled even her most impassioned dreams, relegating them to mere mediocrity. So there you can get an idea of it without me going all the way through it.
Is that it?
There's more, but you gotta get the book.
No, I'm being funny. You know how somebody's so enthralled in listening to what you're saying?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, they go on for, you know, another page and a half with that, so. Yeah, and there are a few more scenes where they get together, so I don't tease you just the one time. You get your money.
Where they get really hot and bothered, huh?
Right, and you see, and that was what I was talking about, the contrast between him and her. You could see how she was really, really reserved and kind of insular, and he's like, I'm ready for this, kind of out there.
Well, see, she was shy. You said at first that she was kind of shy and kind of reserved, right?
Right. And she is for the most part. She comes out of some of that, but she is for the most part. And you see that. You see their personalities even when they're having sex. I'm really careful to just kind of keep those people as, you know, those people. So I really try to, you know, deliver on the promise of the characters throughout the course of the
So in other words, you're one of those, you could be one of those writers for, you don't get the downright and dirty is what you don't do. You try to make it as eloquent and it's love, you know, that type of description.
Well, it depends on the characters and it depends on the situation. For example, when I talked about her sister, remember her sister was in this world where it's basically madness. Now, her encounters, while she's a part of that world, are not going to be anything like that. They're going to reflect that world that she's in, the world of the drugs, the sex, the not being able to trust people, and that kind of thing. So it really just depends on what the situation calls for. I'm very versatile, and I can switch from one to the other, just depending on what's needed for that scene. So you get both kinds, really.
Okay, so in the other book, you'll get the other side of what
you actually get it in the first book too, because there's the sister makes her debut in Crimson Footprints, and in Crimson Footprints 2, she becomes the main character. And so there was one thing that I tried to do in the debut, which was show Dina has a really protective spirit when it comes to her family, and that's part of that acceptance, and she's very protective of her sister and her brother. And you see why she feels so much like a failure, because, you know, in the beginning of the book, her brother gets shot, and then as the book progresses, you see her sister is just gone. She's just beyond reach. And so you see why she feels so much like a failure, and she's really just kind of grasping at family in this desperate way, a family that's already decided to reject her. And so she has to reconsider what family is and what her family will consist of. Because family isn't necessarily the most choosing, it isn't necessarily choosing the most obvious people. It can be your mother, your father, you know, your siblings, but it can also be other people who may not necessarily have been there at the beginning of your life.
Exactly, exactly.
Right, so that's one thing that she, you know, also has to learn.
Okay. Now, I got another question. Would you think about writing in another genre?
Oh, other than romance? I've thought about doing a dystopian novel, because I really, really love, like, dystopian stuff, because at the heart of basically everything I write is this thing about crossing societal boundaries and taboos and that kind of thing. So a lot of the times it's crossing barriers that we don't even realize have been erected. And with dystopian fiction, it basically challenges the world as you see it right now. It's, you know, usually a future world that's crap, but it's based on some ideals that have lost its way somewhere along the way, you know, like Hunger Games and that kind of thing. So I read a lot of dystopian fiction, so I could go in that direction, but it's really hard for me to veer away from romance, because romance is really like that heart at the center of what I do. So I imagine that it would have romantic elements, even if it weren't strictly a romance novel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, I could be pried away. I'm not like obsessive about romance. I could be pried away. I could be bribed to write something else.
But that's really where your love is, right?
Right, right. And it's funny because I don't strictly read romance. I'm not one of those Harlequin junkies, and I don't go see a lot of romantic movies. And I think that's because I see romance a little differently, and that comes through in the novel, because it's not that that cut and dry kind of fix. I had a review, I don't know, maybe a month ago or so, maybe a little less time, from USA Today. They did a review of the first Crimson Footprints, not the second one. And they were saying that, you know, it demonstrates a really sophisticated prose, but it also kind of turns on its head that can't we all just get along, kind of, we have differences dynamic that you find with a lot of interracial romance. So I try to do something new in these books, and I think I pulled it off.
Okay, I got a question for you.
Okay.
What about Miss X Law Student? That you write you a good you write you a good thrill mystery. Because really, even though I don't write in that genre too much, I love mystery, and thriller is my number one.
You know, mystery is so hard to write, and it's funny. I feel like because there's actually another novel that I've kind of been dabbling with, And it doesn't even have a name or anything, but it's kind of like it uses a lot of like history as its backdrop, because the female in it is a PhD student getting her degree in history, but she starts like researching kind of like slave history and this family, this white family that owns slaves there, and she ends up meeting this guy. But she's in pursuit of something in her research that she feels like will make her name, because I love like creating this these really ambitious women. So, you know, she's in pursuit of something that will, you know, really make her name. And so in a way, it's a mystery, because she knows she's onto something, but she doesn't know what it is. Yeah. But, like, mystery is so incredibly hard to write. And I'm just kind of really getting the hang of it, and that's why I haven't, like, put both feet on the pedal with that one just yet, because I'm still... you know, getting the hang of it. But, you know, there's this thing that Agatha Christie said about writing mystery, and she said, and this is, you know, you can take this and run with it. She says that you hide an important move, an essential move, with a really big move. You know, it's that distraction. And, you know, that kind of, that quote just kind of fell into my lap. And then after I had that, I was like, okay, that makes sense. And it was really able to, you know, start kind of flowing after that. But my thing is that I write like 4 books at a time, so I'm not really working on that one right now. I'm kind of kicking my screen while I'm doing Crimson Footprints 3, so, you know, provided I still have a computer tomorrow, we'll see. Yeah, well, you know, you have to kind of maul yourself and abuse yourself, and yeah, you were talking about that, you know. Be like, you know, I'm a loser, this is not working out, oh, no. Yeah, you know, if it weren't for fans, where would you be? They're the only people that, you know, tell you you're great, you know.
Yeah. And sometimes you doubt them.
Yeah, you right. Like, are you sure? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you need a new one every day to remind you.
Now, that's kind of strange that you say that mystery is hard to write.
It is because it's just... It's hiding those things that you need to hide while still having them in plain sight, so the reader doesn't feel cheated. You know? And it's just, it's that juggle, that balance that, I don't know, it's good enough to make me go bald. It's hard. And there are some people that do it really well, but I'm not there yet, and I'm not sure that I will be, so I'm not sure that I'll ever be coming out with, like, a mystery book. But, yeah, as far as mystery as a genre goes, it's awesome, you know, I'm with it. But, yeah, I don't know about me writing it. We'll see. Who knows what it'll bring.
Yeah, but you know what you can do? You can combine both of them. You know that.
And I'm doing that in a small way, but it's like a major movement, just kind of making it like this is a mystery book. I'm not sure that, you know, I'm ready to make that move specifically. Yeah, it's just, there are just plenty of people out there that can do it better than me right now.
So
I will clear the floor for them, you know, and just do your thing.
I don't
go out there and lift my hood and try and fix my own car, you know. You can't do everything. So I'm cool with that. I'm okay with that. You know, you just, as my mom always says, you need to know your lane. You need to stay in it.
You know what? I consider myself, and I always say, the jack of all trades. I might not master not one of them, but I know how to do it.
Exactly. That is so true.
You learn that in the
So basically, you can't do anything well, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. No,
basically,
I can do it
well. That's right there. I cook okay, you know, but I'm one hell of a writer, but I'm only a so-so cook now. You know, my family won't starve. There'll be none of that. But, you know, I won't be on, like, Celebrity Chef anytime soon either.
No.
Yeah, you got to know what you're doing, man. You got to know what you're good at and what you suck at and be okay with that.
I know I suck at a lot of stuff, and I suck at things like not, you know, starting projects and not finishing them. That's number one thing. I think
that's really bad for an author, by the way. That is one of those things you want to, you want to tweak that one a little bit. Because you have a whole lot of, like, almost books that are really, really good. Yeah. You might want
to
work on that one.
You're not supposed to make me laugh like that.
I mean, I'm just, as a friend, I'm just saying, that's a free one right there.
Yeah, we just break it down to you. This is what you need to do, huh?
Yeah, that's one of those ones you might want to remedy.
Yeah. Don't be just telling 100,000 people online.
Yeah, I hear you. But, you know, they say half the battle, you know, is starting, but, you know, maybe for you it's finishing. I guess it just depends. It depends on the person.
Depends on who the person is and how many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm serious. I could be sitting, and you know what? I have another friend who does the exact same thing I do. We sit up, and we can brainstorm our asses off, and we come up with these brilliant ideas to do da-da-da-da all over the place. And then we get started, we look at each other, I can't do
this. Yeah, see, me and you need to pair up, because I suck at brainstorming. I will sit there, and I'll be with another person, and I'll be like, well, I'm dry. I got nothing. And then I'll get mad at the other person because they have no ideas, too. So it's like, you know, I'm like, I said first that I don't have any ideas. That means you need to have at least one. So,
bring something to the table.
Yeah, you need to bring something, you know. So, yeah, we need to pair up because I have nothing. I can do the execution. Like, I'm with it. You give me the idea, I'm gone. But the idea, I will sit there. It's so funny. I'm with my husband, and I try and get him to help me with brainstorming, and he's like, I don't know. I'm not around. I don't know.
Leave me alone. I'm trying to work.
Yeah, and I'm like, you're not taking this seriously. Just think a little more.
Just a little bit more in there.
Right. I'm like following him around. You need to just try a little harder. If you think about this, I'm sure you can come up with something.
And once I get somebody with me who thinks, and I'm really a very good stickler to the ideal that like-minded people. I don't have a lot of friends, and I don't hang out with a lot of people. But the friends that I do have, we all think alike. We're not all writers, but we're all people who have a lot on our mind. We have a lot we could, you know, come together and collab on.
Right.
I mean, I'm good at that. I'm good at bringing people together. I'm good at making stuff happen, but to finish it, I can make it happen, but I didn't tell you it's going to have an ending to it.
You're good at that planning phase. Well, you know, that's the place for people like you. That planning phase, it's just the execution. I hear you. Yeah, and see, me, I'm all about execution. I'm there, and I may or may not have planned to be there.
I'm here.
I'm there and I'm ready to go. Let's get this done. What are we doing again? You know, so.
Oh, my God. You know what? I'm just sitting here. You're talking. I'm thinking about your characters. And my book, The White Dove, I wrote, she was an American. She was a Native American girl. And, you know, in the Native Americans, they suffer from schizophrenia a lot. People don't realize that, and it's hereditary. And so I thought I would do a story about this beautiful green-eyed little girl, Indian girl. And she was a schizophrenic. She got it from her dad, but she didn't know she was. And the way she came about was her dad raped her mom, who was his first cousin.
Whoa.
And he had green eyes. He was black.
And he
had green eyes, so she had green eyes. So I named her Anthony P. is her name, the color of green. And her mom was this professional. She was an architect, the big thing, you know. And she was this troubled little girl, and nobody didn't know why she was so troubled. And she would do stuff. She was stripping. You know, she was just beautiful. You know, she saw her looks as her way of getting over on everybody.
People, right, you know, and that's, yeah.
And she had these little voices in her head talking to her to get her to do all these crazy stuff. So she was doing this stuff and she didn't know, and she was drinking on the side. So her and her friend got into some trouble, and what happened was the guy that she liked winds up killing his girlfriend. And she knew about it. Yeah. And she came up, the girl came up missing. They all went to school together. And the girl came up missing, and nobody didn't know, you know, how she came up missing. She was the only one who knew the true story of what happened. But at the end, the voices came out. Voices did made her attack people and do some crazy stuff. Anyway,
she
saw him, and he wound up in jail because at the end she confessed and told what she knew. And the voices took over, so...
Yeah, that mental health is hell.
And you know what? It was fun writing it because I'm going to tell you, this is what happens to me. I'm going to tell you exactly what happens to me when I get something in my head and how I start my stories. This is basically how the story started. I said, deep inside, Angie P. knew she shouldn't have attacked the nurse. She didn't mean to bite Nurse Wilson's cheek. She could still taste the blood in her mouth. The voices told her that the nurse was trying to smother her, when in reality, Nurse Angie P., the nurse, was starting to get nauseated. Angie P. was starting to get nauseated from the smell of the straitjacket. The fabric seemed to have tightened against her sweaty skin. The voices in her head told her to scream out loudly to get the attention of the nurses. She knew she couldn't take another chance and received another day in here. She wanted to go back to her room. She wanted to go back to her books. She needed her freedom again. The voices was trying to get her to do something crazy, for instance, attempting to bite the straps until her gums bled. She rolled over on her stomach as though that would make the pain go away. Anthony P. remembered she hadn't eaten since yesterday. The voices told her not to eat the food. It was poison.
Whoa, and what's this called again?
This is called White Dove.
The
name of it is White Dove. It's on Amazon.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I'll look for that.
Under. I got it under C.B. McCall because I didn't use my whole name. So it's under C.B. McCall White Dove. And it was that phrase came in my mind one night. I was laying in the bed and that phrase, and I saw this chick in a straitjacket with blood coming out of her mouth.
Whoa! You just picture that in bed.
Yeah, I do that.
That's not cool.
But that's how things come to me. I vision them first, and that could be the first part of the story, and I have to feed from that part of the story to write the rest of the story.
Yeah.
That's what I have to do.
Yeah, I tend to have, like, scenes appear to me, but, yeah, there hasn't been any of that.
I'm not crazy.
No, not that there's anything wrong. Look, I came up on Stephen King. I would say that of, like, all authors, he's probably the one that has influenced me the most, even though you wouldn't think it because I write romance, but the style that I use, Stephen King has this very blunt, he doesn't, like, introduce you to things. He just blurts it.
Yeah,
and
your face.
Right, he just puts it out there, and I'm the same way. I just, you turn the page, you're like, whoa, what just happened? You turn the page back, yeah, okay, that just happened. And like I'm the same way, so I'm all for it, you know. But yeah, I haven't had those experiences.
But
there's nothing wrong with it. Like I said, there's room at the table for everybody. Yeah, it kind of makes me think of Girl Interrupted a little bit.
I know that movie now that you said it. Yeah.
Yeah, they came out with the movie. There was a novel first, or a memoir, or whatever you want to call it.
Exactly, sure.
Yeah, with the geez, I can't remember her name.
Married
to Brad Pitt, or was it Winona Ryder?
I think it was Winona Ryder.
Angelina Jolie.
Evangeline goes, that's who it was.
Yeah, yeah. Because she has like the 40 adopted kids or whatever. Yeah, her.
I don't see how she can do it. I guess all that money and housemates.
Yeah, well, you know, you have the nanny. You spend the hour with them a day. You send them back to the nursery. You know, it's like recess. It's
now,
not a big
deal. I'm going to tell you another book, and this is one of the authors that I interviewed on my show. When I read his book, I was off. I was like, oh, my God, I loved it. His name, it's called Never Dead, and it's by Samantha Hill Jones. And it's about a ghost. And it is the...
Did you say a goat or a ghost?
A ghost.
Oh, I thought you said a goat.
No, I'm
like,
sorry.
Billy Goat.
No. It's a
ghost. Yeah, like Billy Goat Gruff, yeah.
And it's
I'm sorry, proceed, yeah.
You better leave me alone. Okay. So, it's about a ghost. And the ghost, the mystery is who killed him. It's a young boy, and he's literally in the story... And they're trying to find out who killed him. And you'd be surprised who killed him. I mean, that's I told him, I said, Jumanta, this book is off the chain. I love
it. And is it a short story or is it like a full?
It's a novel. It's it's 300 and something pages. Yeah. It is, I mean.
Nice. Okay.
Never Dead. Yep.
Okay. Well, you know that, like I said, there's room at the table for everybody. You know, there are some authors that aren't as open to that idea, and there are others that are, you know, very much okay with it, like you are. But not all. Some authors kind of feel like in order for them to succeed, someone else has to fail, and they kind of. Come out from behind with that idea, and you see it in the way they interact with other people and other authors. And it's for a newer person, it's enough to kind of, you know, rub you the wrong way. But at the same time, you know, I grew up in a big city, so to me, that's not very much different from the way people normally act. But I know of, like, other authors who are equally new or newer who have a very hard time adapting because they don't understand why, you know, some people seem, like, envious of even a small amount of success or a debut or just very, very small things, you know? And, that's basically what I was saying. And that's what I mean when I say, you know, there's
I hope you don't feel that way.
No, I believe that a reader has money for my book and your book too. I don't know where anyone signed up to just, you know, like a contract where they would just read one book in their life, and I don't know about anyone else. But when I finish one book, I go on to another one. So
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, it's like I'm of the belief that as long as I do my job and I do my job well, people will find me and people will enjoy it, and that has nothing to do with any other author. So I think it's more a matter of being insecure, and the best way to combat that is to work on your craft, not on, you know, attacking or being envious of, you know, other authors or whatever. So, right. And that's just the best thing you can do for your readers and for yourself is to work on your craft.
Okay, Shawanda, this is what I need you to do. I need you to tell us where we get a copy of your book from.
Okay, you can grab Crimson Footprints 1 on just about any e-reader. You can grab it in print on Amazon.com. You can go to Barnes & Noble. You can go to Barnes & Noble online. You can grab Crimson Footprints 2 this week in a couple of days. You can get it on any e-reader. Next week on the 26th, it debuts in print. Same places online and in Barnes & Noble. You can walk into a Barnes & Noble and request it. I'm sorry, what?
No, because I'm running out of time on you. I hate that. I don't have to hang up with you. You are such a great person.
Oh, thank you. Well, let me just say these couple of things real quick then since we're running out of time. Anyone that wants to find me can find me at shawandapugh.com. They can follow my blog. It's spelled like she. Wanda Pugh, PUGH.com. You can find me on Facebook, Shawanda Pugh. I'm the only one out there that's a Shawanda Pugh, so I'm really easy to find. You can find me on Twitter, Shawanda P, at Shawanda P. I'll be a featured speaker at the Tucson Festival of Books in about a week and a half. I think that's March 8th and 9th that weekend. I'll also be at Miami Jazz in the Garden, which is the following weekend. So you can come and get Crimson for Prince 1 and 2 signed. And I also have a giveaway on Goodreads for Crimson Footprints 2. So you can just go on there and look for Crimson Footprints 2, and you can enter to win a copy. As long as you're in the U.S., Canada, or Japan, you can win a copy.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Shawanda.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Oh, I had a great time. Thank you again, girl. You have a nice day, and good luck with everything that you're doing, okay?
Thank you. You too, and get back to writing.
Okay, I will. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You guys, that was Shawanda Pugh, the author of Crimson Footsteps. Love the, I mean, lovely woman. Lovely, lovely. Had a great time. Thank you, guys. This is Through the Eyes of the Black Woman with your host, Salita, and I'm going to say bye-bye.